Being relentless means having the courage to say, I'm going for this, and if I'm wrong, I'll make a change, and I'll still be fine. You can't control or anticipate every obstacle that might block your path. You can only control your response and your ability to navigate the unpredictable. Whatever happens, you have the smarts and skills to figure it out and arrive at the outcome you wanted in the first place. And when I say figure it out, I don't mean thinking about it for a week and asking everyone you know what they think. I mean immediately, instinctively, hearing that voice inside saying, this way, and you go. Of course, it's not possible to be 100% accurate and successful all the time. Instinct doesn't recognize nuance and detail. It just flashes at you and allows your skill to take over. So it's entirely possible to rely on instinct and still make the wrong decision. You see that happen in game situations all the time. A batter swings at a pitch that looks good, just before it curves away from him. A lineman anticipates the snap and jumps offside. Perfect example? In Game 4 of the 2012 NBA Finals, with 17 seconds on the clock, 5 seconds on the shot clock, and the Thunder down by 3, Russell Westbrook intentionally fouled Miami's Mario Chalmers, not recognizing it was a don't foul situation. If he had thought about it, he wouldn't have committed the foul, but his instincts told him to foul. And you have to take into account he's young, had never been in that situation before. He's thinking about 17 seconds on the clock, not 5 seconds on the shot clock. Chalmers then made 2 free throws, giving Miami a 5-point lead. And the Thunder lost. Should Westbrook have known better? Of course. But that flash tells me what kind of player he is, and in the long run he's going to benefit from that flash more often than not. Because if the alternative is waiting and thinking and being too timid to snap into action out of fear you'll blow it, you're going to fail anyway. As hockey great and cleaner Wayne Gretzky said, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. You want to know the true sign of a cleaner? He feels no pressure when he screws up and has no problem admitting when he's wrong and shouldering the blame. When a cooler makes a mistake, he'll give you a lot of excuses but no solutions. When a closer makes a mistake, he finds someone else to blame. When a cleaner makes a mistake, he can look you in the eye and say, I fucked up. That's it. Confident, simple, factual, no explanation. You made a mistake? Fine. Don't explain it to me for an hour. The truth is one sentence. I don't need a long story. You tell me you messed up, take responsibility. Now, you've gained my trust. As soon as you start giving me reasons and rationalizations, I know you have something to hide, and you're not ready to take ownership. Save us both the time. You fucked up. Say it. There's no faster way to alleviate pressure. Man, I fucked up. Okay. There's no comeback for that. You owned it. Now, fix it. You can't fix something unless you admit it. People think admitting mistakes creates more pressure because now they're to blame for something. False. The ability to put your hands up and say, yep, my fault, is the greatest way to stop the pressure. Now you only have one objective, resolve the issue. As long as you continue to deny responsibility, you have added the burden of covering your mistake, and you know the truth will eventually come out anyway. Why bother prolonging the drama? You screwed up? Admit it. Cleaners will just get in your face and announce that you fucked up. They're completely desensitized to criticism and blame, and they expect you to be the same. To you, it feels like an attack. To them, it feels like a couple of guys working out a situation. Their confidence level is so high, they have no problem admitting when something has gone wrong. They know they can make it right. No problem. I've made tons of mistakes. I'm going to make plenty more. But I never think of them as failures. Failure, to me, is when you bring other people into it. When you're looking for an out, instead of accepting your own mistake and planning a route to resolving the issue. Once you start blaming others, you're admitting you had no control over the situation, and without that control, you can't create a solution. Are there times when you truly have no control? Absolutely. But at that point, it's on you to figure out how to take charge and navigate forward. Otherwise, you're allowing external pressure to dictate the outcome. Create your own pressure to succeed. Don't allow others to create it for you. Have the confidence to trust that you can handle anything. When you can laugh at yourself and not take every setback seriously, that's confidence. On the other hand, when someone says something to you that you don't like or you don't want to hear, and you allow it to put pressure on you, even for a moment, that's a confidence problem. When you're confident, you don't care about what others think. You can take your mistakes seriously, but still laugh because you know you can and will do better. Cleaners always have the confidence to know they'll get it right. Accept the consequences and move on. If I spend every day working with a guy and he goes out and has a lousy game, I don't blame him for the lousy game. I know everyone else is blaming him for the lousy game, but I'm wondering if something we did in the gym affected his shot. That's my job, and the pressure is on me to ensure he doesn't have two lousy games. It would be easy to shrug it off, most people would, but if you want to be the best, you never have the luxury of shrugging off a bad performance. You face it, fix it, and prepare to do better next time. People ask me if I ever get nervous during games. I get nervous when my guys do stupid things, make bonehead plays, or blow something we worked on, moments that make you think, "You gotta be kidding me. How could you do that?" Because now I have to ask myself if maybe I didn't do something right. Maybe I didn't explain something properly. I told one of my guys recently we had to get his eyes checked. "For what?" he said. "I got perfect vision." "Man, get your fucking eyes checked, okay? You turned the ball over so much this year, I just want to know if there's a vision problem so we can address it. Is it a depth problem? Let's just find out. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I might be wrong, let's find out. Just help me know if I'm not teaching you right, or you're not seeing it right." When I work with Kobe, we try a lot of new things because he's so dedicated to his workouts that we have time and latitude to experiment with different ideas. So when we've worked on something new and he has a rough game, I don't look to him and wonder what he did wrong. I put the pressure on myself to figure out what I need to do differently for him. I have to ask if we did something to affect his shot. Maybe one of the exercises is affecting his movement in a certain way. I need to compensate for all of that. My responsibility, not his. When I spent those few days with Dwayne during the playoffs, we did so much in a short time, there was no chance to really test how his body was going to react. A lot of his muscles had shut down, and now they were suddenly working again. So he was moving at a faster pace, more gracefully, more explosively. And when you've been working at one speed and suddenly you move a lot faster, your timing is going to be jacked. But it didn't even hit me that I needed to explain that to him until the minute he started moving in Game 3 and he immediately turned the ball over because his timing was off. And I just thought, damn, I didn't mention that to him. I realized 99.9% of people watching had no idea that was a factor in the game, but to me, it was all my responsibility, and I blew it. My fault. I know it doesn't sound like a big deal, but to me, it was a very big deal because I missed something I shouldn't have missed. Yes, he had a good game, and Miami won, but maybe he could have played even better, and they could have won by more. And it would have been easy for me to say nothing about it because he had no idea what had happened. He just knew he turned the ball over. But that's not me. When I'm wrong, I'll tell you. My mistake. My miscalculation. And I told him that after the game. That's internal pressure at work. Getting on yourself for something no one else would even notice and challenging yourself to get it right. Not because you have to, but because you want to. Have the confidence to say when you've screwed up, and people will respect you for it. If you did it, own it. If you said it, stand by it. Not just the mistakes, but all your decisions and choices. That's your reputation. Make it count. If you want your opinions to have value, you have to be willing to put them out there and mean what you say. Two things you can't let anyone take from you. You can't let them take away your reputation, and you can't let them take away your balls. That means accepting the pressure of taking responsibility for everything you say and do. Maturity. Experience. Practice. The more educated you become, the more you heighten your ability to adapt to situations because experience gives you a better understanding of nuance, the tiny details no one else would think of or recognize as important. I'm not talking about accepting a single set of rules, taking what one person thinks and making it your own. I want you to put together your own composite of learning, taking what you know and believe, adding what others have taught you, combining everything you've learned, and creating your own set of beliefs. Not one directive that was set by someone else, but establishing your own. When you're young, you have one speed, fast. As you mature, you learn to vary your speed based on the situation. You know when to go slow, when to go full out. Here's the example I give my players. Two bulls stand on top of a hill, a father and a son, looking down on a field of cows below. The son can't wait. "Come on, let's go. We got to run down and get some of those cows." And the father looks at him slowly, wisely, and says, "No, let's walk down and get all the cows." Instinct, not impulse. The most successful people are those with the instincts to respond quickly to anything, without having to go back to the drawing board, watch more film, schedule a meeting to discuss what will be discussed at the meeting, or do any of the other countless things people do to put off making a decision. A couple years ago, I was doing a youth camp for one of the big NBA sponsors, along with one of my players. They were expecting 500 kids. 2,000 showed up. Everyone went into a panic. Not enough stations. Nowhere to put everyone. How did this happen? Who's to blame? Stop. Slow down. What do we have? What do we need? Give me 10 minutes. I threw out the original plan, devised a new one. We'll do it this way. Of course, there's always someone who can't adapt, still clinging to the original failed plan, stammering, but, we were going to do this and that and... No, we're going this way. Conversation over. Cleaned. That's what cleaners do. They ignore the panicking and complaining. They clean up the problem, and they make it work. A closer will adjust himself to the situation. A cleaner adjusts the situation to himself. A closer has to know what he's going to do. A cleaner doesn't. He never wants to be locked in to one plan. He'll know the original plan, and he'll follow it if it feels right to him, but his skills and intuition are so great that he'll usually improvise as he goes. He can't help it. He just goes with the flow of the action, and wherever his instincts take him, that's what you get. When you're a cleaner, you don't compete with anyone. You find your opponent's weakness, and you attack. A cooler does a good job and waits for a pat on the back. A closer does a good job and pats himself on the back. But a cleaner just does a good job. That's his job. When you're a cleaner, there's no such thing as a meaningless game. Doesn't matter if it's the first preseason event or a mid-season all-star game or the last game in a losing season, a cleaner shows up to play. During the 2012 All-Star Game, things got a little intense. Dwayne fouled Kobe, gave him a concussion, and broke his nose. Even for a regular season game, that would have been a lot of damage, but this was the All-Star Game, and a lot of people thought Dwayne was out of line. That's a cleaner. He sees a situation, his killer instinct kicks in, and he attacks. He thinks, I own this. This is what I do. No hard feelings. But this story is about two cleaners. And after the game, there was Kobe, surrounded by an army of doctors and league officials and team personnel trying to examine him and get him to the hospital. He can barely move, nose busted, head ringing, and he's refusing to go. Why? He wanted to see Dwayne and address the situation. Eventually, though, we got him to leave. Dwayne apologized the next day, Kobe refused to miss a game, and the story faded away. No hard feelings. But believe this, when you get two relentless individuals going against each other, that situation can play out for years. They can still be cool with each other, hang out, get along, but the cleaner inside never forgives and never ever forgets. That's how cleaners compete. They dish it out, they take it, and they make sure everyone else does too. But not everyone can. I have this theory, yet to be disproven, that any player 6'10" or over cannot handle harsh, confrontational criticism. With someone 6'9" or under, you can get in his face and just blast him, but any taller, he'll just lose it and go right into a shell. I think it comes from a lifetime of being stared at and gawked at for being so much bigger than the rest of the population, people pointing and making height jokes, so the tall guys become more sensitive and self-conscious. They're just emotional softies. They can be complete killers in competition, but they're also the guys you have to pat on the back, boost their confidence, and make them feel good about what they're doing. The little guys? You can call them every name imaginable, and they keep right on going. I bring this up to give you an example of how different people respond to competitive smackdowns. This was back during one of the Bulls' championship runs, and Scottie Pippen was trying to get Luke Longley fired up during the finals. All the players were together before the game, and Scottie was talking to Luke, who stands 7'2" tall. "Need you to bring your A game," said Scottie. Before Luke could respond or even nod, Michael whipped around in front of everyone and said, "Bring your A game? Bring a game." Luke was done. I don't think he scored once. Confident shot. Good night. Michael didn't know, or didn't care to know, how to psychologically deal with teammates. For all his countless gifts as a player, sensitivity to others was not among them. He was driven to attack, dominate, and conquer in every way. Whatever he had to do, he did it, and he expected the same from every individual around him. And every day, those teammates had to show up to face him in practice, completely dreading what was ahead, not because practices were hard, but because they knew they had to deal with number 23 and that legendary mouth every fucking day. Just absolutely going after each and every guy, pushing, demanding, challenging, abusing, finding every possible way to get under their skins and make them go harder. Once during the playoffs, on the day after a grueling overtime game, the team was ready to start practice until Michael looked around and noticed one guy was missing. "Where the hell is Burrell?" he barked. Scott Burrell, a part-time player at best, was in the training room. Michael stormed in there, where poor Scott was on the table getting treatment for an alleged hamstring issue. MJ grabbed the table, with Scott still on it, and completely flipped it over. "I just played 48 fucking minutes last night," Michael roared. "Everything's killing me, and you have a fucking hamstring? Get your fucking ass in the fucking practice now." "Get on my level, or get the hell out of my way. When you're the guy at the top, it's on you to pull everyone else up there with you, or everything you've built comes crashing down. Not so easy for a cleaner who demands excellence of himself and has no tolerance for those who can't or won't rise to that level. Does he dumb himself down so he can fit in? Slap people on the back? Tell them they're great and hope everyone can rise together? Or does he stand up there alone, set the example, and make everyone else work harder? The answer seems obvious, but you'd be surprised by how many people don't want to stand alone under the glare of the spotlight, because as soon as you reveal what you're capable of, that's what everyone will expect of you. But when no one realizes how good you are, you don't have to be the guy making miracles and running the show. No one will expect much, and everything you do will seem heroic. Easier that way. Easier, that is, if you're okay being average. A lot of gifted people will lower their skills to close the gap between themselves and those around them so others can feel more comfortable, involved, and relatively competitive. I've seen Kobe do that briefly when he has to, as a way to bring his teammates into the action and keep them engaged. It can work well, depending on the other players, and as soon as Kobe sees his teammates stepping up, he'll revert to his natural game. It's a conscious decision to make the other guys feel as if they were one team, not one superstar surrounded by a second-rate supporting cast. Michael went the other way and came right out and said it. That's my supporting cast. His message was clear and unrelenting. He's saying, hey, I'm not bringing my game down so you can look better. You bring your game up so you can look better. He refused to put his own game in the back seat, just to give other guys more action, unless you proved to him you could handle the responsibility. If you ever watched the Jordan-era Bulls, you know this scene. Paxson brings the ball up the middle, kicks it to Michael on the wing. Michael throws it to Cartwright. Cartwright takes the shot, he scores or doesn't. Next possession, same thing. Paxson brings the ball up the middle, kicks it to Michael on the wing. Michael passes it to Cartwright, he scores or doesn't. Okay, Cartwright, you got your two touches, you're done for the game. Don't say I didn't give you the fucking ball. Now I gotta go do what I need to do. During a game, Michael would assess who was and wasn't giving 100% and make his own adjustments. He never showed frustration on the court. His body language and demeanor never changed. He'd just say, you're not playing tonight? That's fine. I'll play for all five of us. You keep it close in the fourth quarter. I'll do the rest. And he'd do it in a way that uplifted everyone else, as if that were the game plan all along. It's far more typical for stars to get aggravated and emotional when their teammates don't show up, and when everyone falls apart because, as we've discussed, emotions make you weak, and all that emotional energy is completely destructive. But Michael never showed it inside the lines during the game. He always stayed positive, always had fun out there. After the game, he was like Genghis Khan. He'd go after your balls and your head and everything in between. But during the game, while he was in that zone, it was all about taking control, staying cool, and getting that end result. Before Dennis Rodman was traded to San Antonio to the Bulls in 1995, he would occasionally decide to take a night off, and every time he did, the Spurs would lose. The message? Can't win without me. So when he got to Chicago, and was eventually hit with an 11-game suspension for kicking a courtside photographer, he couldn't wait to show that the Bulls couldn't win without him either. Really? On Michael Jordan's team? Every game Rodman missed, Michael and Scottie played as if it were a championship. There was zero chance Michael was going to allow Rodman the opportunity to say the Bulls needed him to win. And he didn't talk about it behind Rodman's back. He said it straight to his face. Your bullshit won't fly here. We will win with you or without you. He was saying, get on my level. Michael knew who was ready and whom he could trust. He loved Steve Kerr because Kerr would stand up to him. During a now legendary training camp scrimmage, Kerr didn't appreciate something Michael said, snapped at him, and Michael punched him in the face. "It was one of the best things that ever happened to me," Kerr said years later. "I needed to stand up and go back at him. I think I earned some respect." He was right. As soon as practice ended, Michael called him from his car, apologized, and from that point on, Michael knew they could go to battle together. No one would have imagined that Kerr, a closer as a player and a total cleaner in everything he earned after departing the Bulls, including two more rings with the Spurs, a career in the broadcast booth, and a stint as GM of the Phoenix Suns before returning to his television career, would be the player Michael trusted the most on the team. When Michael needed to make a fast adjustment because he knew he wasn't going to be able to get a shot off on the next play, it was Kerr he'd look for and say, "Steve, be ready." Not Scotty, not Horace, or Kukoc. Michael trusted Kerr. That's a cleaner, deciding what the closer will do. A closer can never be put into the cleaner's role unless the cleaner decides that's the best way to go. No way Kerr was taking a last-second shot unless Michael wanted him to. And there's also no way Kerr would have had a second chance if he wasn't successful the first time. People like to make comparisons between Magic and Michael. But Magic looked for Kareem on the floor. Michael looked for no one. He used to tell the guys at the beginning of the season, "I'm going to pass you the ball one time. If you don't do something with it, I'm not throwing it to you again. I can miss a shot on my own. I don't need your help for that. So make something happen, because you're only getting one chance. Earn it." When a cleaner puts you in a position to execute, you'd better be prepared. At some point, whether you're in the boardroom or the locker room or anywhere else you want to excel, someone is going to point in your direction and say, "You." It may be an opportunity that lasts a minute, maybe 10 minutes, maybe a week or a month. But what you do in that time is going to determine what you're going to do for a long time after. Someone is going to do something the coach or the boss doesn't like. Maybe a guy isn't playing well or working hard enough, and you're going to get the chance to take his spot. Will you be ready? Will you have done the work that allows you to step in fully prepared and show you should have had that job all along? Have you been finding ways to stay sharp and focused? Because if you do well and impress someone, you're in the system. Now the head guy knows he can go to you, and you've added a weapon to his arsenal going forward. But if you don't do well, you're done. The next guy will get the opportunity you didn't grab. You got your chance. You won't get another. A cleaner tells you what he expects and demands you deliver. Dwight Howard tells a great story about calling Kobe just before the start of the Lakers' 2012 preseason to tell him he was feeling good, that his surgically repaired back was probably at 85%. "That's good," said Kobe. "Need you at 100%. Trying to win a ring. Bye." "Get on my level or get out of my way." Michael forced every one of his teammates to be ready, to play better, harder, stronger, and every one of them ended up with careers they could not duplicate when they were no longer playing with him. "You don't have to like it," he said, "but you'll like the results." And he was right. They didn't like it, but they all elevated their games. They all looked better than they were, and they all got a payday. Even the guys with 0 minutes, he made them better too. He took the pressure off everyone and put it all on himself. And when they eventually had to play without him, either because he left or because they went to other teams, almost physically and mentally, you'd watch some of them in the post-Bulls era and think, "You got to be kidding me. What happened to that guy?" Teams were signing ex-Bulls and suddenly realizing, "We paid all that money for this?" What happened